I'm Bob Workman. I'm a retired Coast Guard captain, Coast Guard aviator number 914, and Coast Guard helicopter pilot number 458. My wife says I belong in a museum. I can give you, I've been stationed at Coast Guard Air Station San Diego, Coast Guard Air Station Annette, Alaska, Coast Guard Air Station St. Petersburg, Florida, Coast Guard Air Station Brooklyn, New York, Coast Guard Air Station Detroit, Michigan, and then they caught up with me for staff duty, and I was Chief of Boating Safety Division and Federal Law Enforcement for the 9th Coast Guard District out of Cleveland, and from there I was assigned to Coast Guard Headquarters for a operations research study of the resources and policies for the National Search and Rescue System that was directed to be done by the Office of Management and Budget. My last year and a half before I retired was at headquarters and assigned unofficially to Vice President Bush's staff because the JAGs at the Pentagon were refusing to let the Coast Guard use intelligence sensors to assist in tracking and capturing for boarding parties traffickers in cocaine and arms from the Caribbean. So I spent about most of my time at the National War College for logistics and administrative support, and much of my time was down in the jungles of Colombia and the Guavar Peninsula, in the jungles of Panama and Nicaragua, and I coordinated closely with General Gorman's staff at SYNC Southcom when it was still in Panama. So that's basically my assignments. I was a qualified aircraft commander in the H-13 helicopter, the H-04S-3G helicopter, the H-52 helicopter, the H-3C, the HH-3A, and the HH-3E, the Air Force versions of the H-3, and the HH-3F in the Coast Guard. Also was had about 6 months in the P-5M under instruction at Corpus Christi Naval Air Station in Texas, but mostly flew the Grumman Albatross, the HU-16E, out of San Diego and Annette. Annette was a real eye-opener for experience. San Diego was a good opener for a young pilot straight out of flight training. We did many medical evacuations as well as offshore landings. With the last of the offshore landings in the Coast Guard. The interesting thing about the medical evacuations were we tried to get away from having to land offshore whenever we were evacuating from a ship with a fixed wing. The helicopters hadn't really developed enough to go far or to stay out for very long, so most of the medevacs were by fixed wing. So we would ask a Navy ship, for example, if he had, let's say he had a seaman with a battery that blew up in his face and he had metal fragments in his eyes and he needed to be evacuated to the Naval Hospital in San Diego, we would fly down to Magdalena Bay in Baja, Mexico. We'd ask the destroyer to head over to Baja while we were flying down there. We would land in Magdalena Bay. Well, the California gray whale, many who have gone to Alaska and gone to Glacier Bay have seen the California gray whales up there. Well, they migrate down to Magdalena Bay for birthing and for mating. So we would land in the water and shut down the engines while we're waiting for the launch from the destroyer, for example, bringing the patient over to us. And the whales would have fun with us. We'd be looking down at the whales and they would be pushing us around. The fuselage in the water must have looked like a whale to them, but they would turn us around in circles and didn't do anything to hurt the aircraft. They were very very gentle with us, but it was a lot of fun just watching that. That was kind of a unique experience. Up in Annette, that was pretty horrible flying conditions. We had 6 fathoms of rain a year. That's 36 feet of rain a year. And in the wintertime, that was all ice and snow. So the flying conditions were treacherous up there. Plus, you had mountains on either side. And as a result, we lost 3 aircraft and 27 people while I was up there. I'm not going to go into some of the cases up there because the flying was too brutal. We'll go down now to St. Petersburg, Florida. And I'll describe one of the cases I had in 1967 with the H-52 helicopter. 120 miles offshore, the coastal freighter Cecil Ann was sinking in a winter storm with 28-foot seas. That's 56 feet from trough to crest, with 6 crew on board. And these the crew were all 300-pound football-build guys. Well, the H-52 was designed to hoist 4 200-pounders. So that would have put me a little over 1,000 pounds over gross weight for the helicopter, which wasn't designed for that. Dewey Barfield took off in a Grumman Albatross from St. Petersburg Air Station to locate them and to try to drop pumps and rafts to them. And the wind was so fierce that it blew them away, and the ship was sinking. So he called us out about 2 a.m. And so we headed out in an H-52, and we got on scene just as they were leaving because they were low on fuel. So here we are out there at night in a single-engine helicopter 120 miles offshore in a fierce winter storm, looking to hoist 6 people that the helicopter wasn't designed to hoist. So we discussed the situation of the crew and asked if any of them had any objections or didn't want to take the risks, and they all agreed with my evaluation. So I told the hoist operator for the last 2 hoists, if the survivor butt hits the sea, you're to jettison the hoist and we're done. They're done. That was their only chance to survive, but we will take it and hope for the best. So the first 4 came up fine as a normal hoist. The second one, I was using maximum power just to stay in a hover. Now realize that this is at night, offshore. There are no lights, there's no horizon, so this is a full instrument hoist. I'm on instruments the whole time. My co-pilot, Norm Huff, did a wonderful job. He was monitoring the instruments for me, doing the navigation for me, keeping track of the fuel, and things that I just couldn't be diverted from because I had my hands full just trying to fly the helicopter in as stable a hover as I could for the hoist operator. The 5th hoist, as I said, was maximum power, and it was right at the limit. We have an instrument in the cockpit that has a red bar that goes across it that's a torque limiter that tells you when you've over-torqued the engine. So he was monitoring that as part of his duties as well. The last survivor, the 6th survivor, I had to refer back to my HO4S days before we had standardization. We flew the flight envelope back then. We didn't have standardized numbers that we flew by. And so with that machine, you had to milk that helicopter to get everything out of it you could for staying airborne when you're getting heavy. And so I used many of those procedures since we had the same rotors and the same rotor gearbox as the HO4S. So the last hoist was done with transational lift. So I told the operator, now we're going to do a flyby a little over 15 knots, and you're going to instruct him to jump in the basket as we go by. If he makes it, great. If he doesn't, we only have enough fuel for 1 try. And so he made it, And I told Chazaru, my hoist operator, I said, now if his butt so much as hits the water, remember, you locate that explosive bolt for the hoist cable, and you hit that explosive bolt and jettison the basket, because that'll be our way to fly out of it. And as long as he is coming up faster than we're going down, we'll continue. And so he acknowledged that, and everybody in the crew acknowledged that it was a worthy risk, and we would go ahead and take it. So fortunately, he came up faster than we went down, and he was brought aboard. And by that time, I had over-torqued the main engine and over-torqued the main gearbox for the rotors. And so I was instructing the crew to keep their ears open for any grinding noise from the gearbox or from the engine. And I flew at 150 feet, ready to go into a full auto rotation to the surface if we lost an engine or if the gearbox started to grind and was in danger of freezing up on us. My co-pilot had calculated that Cedar Keys, Florida, was the closest point of land, and so we were heading directly for Cedar Keys. At about daybreak, we arrived at the beach at Cedar Keys after watching the fuel warning lights for about 15 minutes before we got to the beach. So I put it down right on the beach, and two other helicopters from St. Pete Air Station came up to meet us and took my crew and the survivors back to the air station. There's a fuel truck was driven up from the air station to refuel us, and a mechanic came over and stuck the tanks to measure how much fuel I had remaining, and he said I had 8 minutes of fuel to dry tanks. And so we refueled at Crystal City Airport. I picked it up, and it was a half mile away. I picked it up and flew over there and met the fuel truck. They refueled us, and I flew back to St. Petersburg Air Station, and there the old man was waiting for me. And I figured this is probably one of those situations where you either had a court-martial or you were going to get an award, one of the two. So Norm Miley was my skipper, and he says, don't worry, you did a good job, Bob. And then a semi-flatbed came out of from behind the hangar and with a crane, and they hoisted the helicopter on the flatbed and strapped it down and drove it to Elizabeth City for overhaul, because it was considered an unflyable airplane at that point. And the 1426 was a replacement helicopter, and which is that helicopter now is hanging in Udvar-Hazy, Smithsonian Air and Space Museum. From there, I went up to Coast Guard Air Station Brooklyn, New York, and flew both H-52s and H-3s up there. And I'll relate one case up there. Early in the morning, about 1 o'clock, I got a call from Rescue Coordination Center saying that they wanted me to fly an H-3 down to, this was my duty night, down to Naval Operations Base, Norfolk, and where they would refuel me and be met by a Navy neurosurgeon. The nuclear submarine SS Flying Fish had a torpedoman whose head had been crushed in the forward torpedo room, and he needed to be given medical attention or an evacuation back to the Naval Hospital in Norfolk, in Portsmouth. The problem was, all the airports were closed down from obscured ceilings and visibility on the East Coast. And we said we had about a 70-foot ceiling and less than a quarter-mile visibility, and I had to go out 150 miles offshore at night to rendezvous with the flying fish. Fortunately, Elizabeth City Air Station had a C-130 that had located the submarine and was orbiting over it, and they vectored me directly to the sub so that I wouldn't waste any fuel getting there, so I could do the hoist and get back. Picked up the doctor, the neurosurgeon, we flew out and arrived on scene, flew out about 70 feet off the surface out there, and The first hoist was kind of wild because we had heavy seas. The submarine had submerged with only the conning tower showing above the surface so as to try to stabilize the submarine from too much rocking and rolling. But the sail on the sub was still whipping back and forth, which made it very difficult to stay over the hatch and the sail there on the sub to get the doctor on board. Plus, when the sub was submerged, I had no visual reference whatsoever. So again, it's a hoist on instruments without any outside reference for visual reference. And so it was a very difficult hoist. It was a wild ride for the doctor. He went over the side in the basket and was being lowered, and he was swaying back and forth in the basket as a hoist operator was trying to keep the helicopter in the basket over the conning tower, and he lost his medical bag over the side. It was so violent. And he was scared to death, and we brought him back up for another try, and he tried to scramble out of the basket, and my hoist operator took his hand and put it on his forehead and shoved him back into the basket, and over the side he went again to go down to the sub. And this time we were successful in getting him on board. We all decided, the skipper of the sub and the doctor and myself, that it was too dangerous to try to bring the patient up in those conditions. So the neurosurgeon stayed on board and stabilized him. And the submarine sank, went below the surface, and sailed into Norfolk underwater. Well, we still had to get back. So I didn't want to go back at 50 to 70 feet off the surface again. So I climbed up to an IFR and filed IFR for an instrument flight back to the Hampton Roads area, which was the closest point to land, because we were at the maximum distance offshore for the H3, which is 150 miles. It's 300-mile round trip with allowing you 20 minutes for hoisting. Well, we were on the fuel warning lights for the last 15 minutes before we got to the beach, and I contacted Langley Air Force Base for a ground control radar, GCA approach. And they said, sorry, the airport's closed. We're not accepting any inbound traffic. And I said, but all the other airports up and down the East Coast are closed, and this is Coast Guard Rescue. And I gave them my tail number, and I told them what we'd been doing, and we're coming inbound, and we are landing because I won't have any fuel to take us any further, and I would really like to stay clear of buildings or obstructions when we came down. And they're, sorry, sir, we can't give you a GCA, so let me speak to the supervisor. And this sergeant came on. I love sergeants and chief petty officers. They're the guys that get the job done. And the sergeant was on there and said, commanding general says we can't give you any GCAs. It's a direct order. And I said, well, sergeant, can you give me a practice GCA? Did he tell you couldn't give me any practice GCAs? And he says, absolutely not, sir. We sure can give you a practice GCA. Come, and then he gives me a heading to come to, and he brought us straight in. Well, the GCA takes you down to 100 feet and a quarter mile visibility. So we brought us into a hover at 100 feet, and we couldn't see a thing. So we started letting down a little bit at a time and a little bit at a time. The procedures are that while you're letting down, the pilot flies the helicopter on instruments while the co-pilot is looking for a visual contact. And when he gets visual contact, he says, contact. And then he takes the helicopter controls, and you look up as a pilot. And when you have contact, and you say, contact, I have it. And you take it back and you land. That's the normal procedure. So that happened at about 2 feet above the deck when we first saw the runway and taxi lights. And we called into Langley approach and said, can you guys send a ground vehicle out to bring us in? Because we haven't the slightest idea where we are, and we can't see where we are. And they did, so we remained overnight, refueled in the morning. And the Air Force guys were amazed when we took off in the morning and flew back to Brooklyn Air Station. We also did some armed boarding party deliveries at Brooklyn Air Station with the Soviet fishing fleet offshore. And they were a lot of fun. You go out to Montauk Point with your armed boarding party on board with fast ropes attached inside, and you would make a high-speed run after you looked like a charter boat going out with the charter boats on the vessel you wanted to board, and do a half Cuban eight, taking pictures, come up to a quick stop overhead, and the repelling lines would go over and the boarding crew would go aboard, and you really got your jollies off flying that one. The only other one I had that might be of interest would be, and that's strictly a historical thing, is when I was exec at our Coast Guard Air Station Detroit up on the Great Lakes. I scrambled out at night on the sinking of the Edmund Fitzgerald. For those of you who may have heard Gordon Lightfoot's song, The Edmund Fitzgerald, that's the sinking of the ore boat Edmund Fitzgerald. When we arrived there, it had already sunk and taken all hands down, so we couldn't do a thing. But that was kind of an interesting scramble. We had at Brooklyn Air Station one other one I ought to mention, and that is we scrambled out with Paul Resnick took an H-3, went ahead of us, and I was in an H-52 flying from Floyd Bennett Field in Brooklyn to the Great Lakes. The 9th Coast Guard District up in the Great Lakes had a severe winter storm came through, and it spawned a lot of tornadoes, and they had over 250 boats overdue and missing. And it was too much for them to try to handle on their own, so they were asking for assistance from other Coast Guard districts. So it was a frontal passage with lots of hail and thunderstorms. And I was very glad to have the H-3 with its radar flying ahead of me and telling us where to stay clear of thunder cells with hail. And we were getting beat up pretty badly with headwinds. And so we fought all night and got as far as Wilkes-Barre-Scranton and airport, and where we landed to refuel, because we were running low on fuel as well, and we decided we were tired and we needed to get some sleep. So we checked in with Erie Station, lifeboat station on Lake Erie, to let them know where we were, and gave them our phone number, and went to the local motel, and about 2 a.m. we were called and said, you guys got to get up and get going to the Vermilion, Ohio, which is up by Sandusky, because the Vermilion Dam had burst. And there were houses and trailers being washed out into Lake Erie. And there are people on roofs and in the water and such. Well, Paul had gotten there ahead of us in the H-3 because it was a faster helicopter. And we flew a foot on the beach and a foot over the water, because again we had about 70-80 foot ceilings and about a quarter of a mile visibility again. So we flew all the way from Erie to Vermilion, and when we got there, fortunately the front had passed and we had VFR conditions, but it was a mess. It was a massive flood. Floodwaters that had come down. Now, the town of Vermilion had 200-year-old oak trees nestled right up against the houses. They're huge oak trees. And so we had to take the helicopter to clear the area where you could get a hoist basket down through the trees to get to people. You had to push the helicopter down into the trees to spread the branches so that it opened up a hole for you to drop the basket down. And we had one of those where there's a lady with a broken hip, and she was panicking. So we didn't have rescue swimmers back then. So Glenn Sirotsky was my co-pilot, and I had Glenn take a PRC-16 radio with him, remote radio with him, and he was lowered down, and he had to swing back and forth and crash through a window to get into the house, stabilize the lady. We lowered the Stokes litter to him. He had her strapped in Stokes litter, and we brought her up and then brought him up. Well, before we were done, we had hoisted 16 people from rooftops and out of the water and brought them over to a football field that was just above the surface of the water where there was a police car. And we so we set up a command station with a police car to keep the locals informed of what we were doing and who we were bringing in and that sort of thing. So that was an interesting trip. And after that, when I went to headquarters, the operations research study established a lot of the resources and policies that are used in the National Search and Rescue System today. I guess that's about the story of my career. It was a wonderful career. I loved the Coast Guard. I loved what I did. I miss it a great deal, and I miss the comradeship and the friendship of those I served with.